the interior castle by Saint Teresa of Avila. Bishop said to me yesterday that, well, you have quite a concentration of mystical works this week, don't you? We had Simone Weil, who is in a sense a mystic, although not chiefly famous as a mystic, I think. And then yesterday we had the Way of a Pilgrim, and now today Saint Teresa. But then this will close the mystics as far as this series is concerned. Tomorrow we'll pick up Bonhoeffer, Letters and Papers from Prison. And on Monday, we'll speak about a quite remarkable book by a missionary in India called Christ and India by B. Griffiths. And on Tuesday, the one by a French writer, Jacques Ellul, The Presence of the Kingdom, also a very stimulating book. I was just thinking of how it works out that Christian life is international. It isn't limited to any one people. Yesterday we were in Russia the whole hour, today we're in Spain, and now tomorrow it'll be Germany, and on Monday it'll be India, and on Tuesday it'll be France. So that's how it goes, and that's the wonderful thing about it, that the life in Christ, the spiritual life, isn't limited to any country, and those who walk in that way find themselves at home with others on the way, no matter from what country they've come. Now, I must say, of course, I feel that saying it to some degree about every book, that I approach it with a sense of inadequacy. These books are so much there, and they are the distillation of great life, great faith, that you feel very inadequate to try to present them or discuss them. But I think more than ordinarily, I feel that way about St. Teresa. Because I feel that one is walking in territory which she knew and which she described, but much of which lies beyond our experience. I think that I put it just that way. It lies beyond our experience. She writes in a very humble spirit, so in that sense we don't need to be afraid of her. Over and over again she says, well, this is what she thinks, or this is the way it seems to her, but she certainly is not dogmatic, and she writes under the authority of the church, so that if she has anything doctrinally wrong, she is glad to have it corrected. So there's a spirit of humility there, but you have a sense of being in the presence of a master in her field, just as you do, I think, when you hear a great musician play or a great poet read his poetry. I want to say too, before we go into the book itself, that she was a nun, and she wrote her book for nuns. It's addressed to the nuns in her convents. But she says, or at least is implied throughout, that this is not just for the nuns, it isn't just for the people in the monastery, it's equally much for those of us who are, as they say, in the world, who are living an ordinary life in the world. She writes to describe the spiritual life, Christian character, Christian level of experience. And she does analyze it to the extent that sometimes it's frightening to us, I think, because we say, how can she go so much into detail after all. But as I said, I want to say before I begin the book that to come near to St. Teresa is a wonderful experience. You feel yourself in the presence of a great Christian soul. But the saints are not necessarily in the monasteries. And both you and I have met many people along the way of life. Clergymen, pastors' wives, some of them, lay people of various kinds and callings who have this same spirit. They wouldn't be able to write a book about it. It probably wouldn't occur to them to do so. They might not even know that their life could be analyzed. So, but their spirit is there. And that's one of the wonderful things, I think, of traveling around, when that is our privilege, is to meet some of these people who have entered into a really deep, rich Christian experience. And as I look back over my life, I can think of a number of people like that through the past years, as well as more recently, who it seemed to me have some of the spirit that is described in a book like this, even though they couldn't write books about it. And it's good for us to remember that some of them have absolutely no education. They don't know any theology. They can read the Bible, of course, because in our country, well, everybody can read. Yeah, where this pilgrim was yesterday, or many who couldn't read, so he was surprised sometimes when he found that people could read. But it's good for us to remember, too, that St. Teresa didn't have any education. She was unlearned, didn't have any formal education. Or she had learned much there in the monastery. Well, I say that because this is a kind of a doctrine of an aristocracy of spiritual life. But they aren't in the monastery, all of them, and they're not all in the parsonages. They are in many different places. I met a woman, I would say a young woman, but I learned afterward that she was much older than I thought. Out on the prairies of Montana, 40 years ago or so. I saw her only once or twice. She was a retired school teacher. But for some reason or other, maybe there was something in me too that was particularly receptive at that moment. I can't remember her name anymore. But through 40 years, I felt the impact of that personality in Christ out there on the prairies. Well, now I imagine that some of you wouldn't even know which century St. Teresa lived in. It's very common because she is not well known. Imitation of Christ is much better known. And most everybody knows about Pilgrim's Progress and so on. And this is a kind of a Pilgrim's Progress. But St. Teresa is not so well known. 16th century. She died in... 1580, and she was not very old. I didn't even check. Well, in fact, I thought of checking, but I don't think the date of her birth is given here. But she was about 67, I think, at the time of her death. And this book was written just shortly before her death, about 3 years before, 1577, and was written in a period of about 6 months. And it was written under orders. She says, she contended that she didn't have any ability to write, but her superiors, you see, and those people, of course, obeyed orders, that's part of their life. They knew better than she did that she had some ability to write. And so her superior ordered her to write this book. Now she had written several others before this. And her superior tells in a little paragraph about how she came to write this book. Now, what happened with regard to the Book of the Mansions is this. Once, when I was her superior, his name is Father Gracian, G-R-A-C-I-A-N, Father Gracian. Once, when I was her superior, I was talking to her about spiritual matters at Toledo. And she said to me, "Oh, how well that point is put in the book of my life, which is at the Inquisition." See, one of her books is called Her Life. She had written, I think, about three before. One was the, I didn't check that either, one was the book of Foundations, telling about her, the various monasteries or that she had founded, and then this book about her life, and then this, I think it's called The Way of Perfection, was the other one. And this is very characteristic of her, you know. You see, this point that we're talking about now, I have that very well stated in my book. If you haven't gotten beyond false humility, well, you probably wouldn't say that. You might think that, well, I've got that very well stated in my book, but she said, "Well," I said to her, "as we cannot get at that, see, the Inquisition had taken it over. They had to examine and see what they want to publish." She had her trouble all along the line. After this thing was written, it was gone over by some of these superiors of hers, you know, every sentence, and then they make suggestions, so on. And that's recorded somewhat in the manuscript, which they still have. And that makes very interesting reading, too, what the professor of theology, who was a very man, was repeating there, and what some reason why she did that. Although, actually, they didn't change very many things. Well, if you cannot get at that, why not recall what you can of it and other things and write a fresh book and expound the teaching in a general way without saying to whom the things that you describe have happened? And she certainly followed that literally, because many times in the book she says, "I heard of a person who stole and so." She's talking about herself. "I know of a person who stole and that person." She means herself. Without saying to whom the things that you describe have happened. "It was in this way that I told her to write this book of the mansions, telling her, so as to persuade her better, to discuss the matter with Dr. Velasquez, who used sometimes to hear her confessions, and he told her to do so too." And so she started on Trinity Sunday, or was it Trinity, the day after Trinity, in 1577. She was then away, and she remained there for about 3 months at Toledo. She was in Toledo. And she seems to have gotten quite a distance into the book, about through the first four mansions or so. And then she had to lay it aside and didn't get back to it until she got back to her home community. And there she finished it in November of that year. So it occupied about 6 months, but actually she was working at it only about 3 months. And you know, to write a book in the midst of many other responsibilities, she was, of course, a leading person by this time. She had been a leader in the reform of the monastery. There were so many things that were wrong. They had their reform movements. They had the fundamentalists that approved wanted things just to be the way they had always been, you know, and without so much discipline. And then they had these reformers who wanted more strict discipline, they're even called the discalced ones, that is, the ones who didn't wear shoes, because this was supposed to be a special form of discipline. So she had all of her activities to take care of, and had to write this book in between. If any of you tried to do that, you know that it isn't easy. It's much easier if you can get out somewhere where you aren't disturbed. Well, now she tells how she had gotten that order. See, I think I have a little, the introduction here gives us a little idea of the style in which she writes. Such was the origin of The Interior Castle, one of the most celebrated books on mystical theology in existence. It is the most carefully planned and arranged of all St. Teresa wrote. She was not really an orderly person when it came to writing. She sat down and went from one thing to the other. but this is the most carefully ordered of her writings. The mystical figure of the mansions gives it a certain unity, which some of her other books lack. The lines of the fortress of the soul are clearly traced, and the distribution of its several parts is admirable in proportion and harmony. Where the book sometimes fails to maintain its precision of method and falls into that sweet disorder, I like that phrase, which in St. Teresa's other works makes such an appeal to us, is in the secondary themes which it treats, in the furnishing of the mansions, as we might say, rather than in their construction. She gets off on sidelines, and then she says, that reminds me of this, and that reminds me of that, and so she goes on and all that. Now, a scholastic letter, for that matter, anyone with a scientific mind would have carried the logical arrangement of the general plan of every chapter. Such a procedure, however, would have left no outlet for St. Teresa's natural spontaneity. It is difficult indeed to say how far experiential mysticism can ever lend itself to inflexible scientific rule without endangering its own spirit. Since God is free to establish an ineffable communion with the questing soul, the soul must be free to set down its experiences as they occur to it. So she writes in that kind of a free and easy and familiar way. Very often she says, my dear sisters, oh, can't you see this? And don't you catch a glimpse of this? Now, St. Teresa entered the monastery when she was about 20. But it was when she was about 40, after having been in the monastery and supposedly living the religious life for about 20 years, that she had one of those experiences which are so characteristic of many of the great spiritual leaders, that she came to a new vision of Christ. It came to her while she was looking at a picture of Christ's passion. And almost like you've heard the story about Zinzendorf, I think, that he looked at a picture of Christ on the cross beneath it and said, all this I have done for thee, what hast thou done for me? And this made a great impression on Zinzendorf. Or something like that in the case of St. Teresa. And she entered into a newness of experience in, shall we say, in a special way as a result of that. Without that experience, I don't think that these books of hers, well, at least they would have been very different books from what they are. Now she had her orders to write. And she tells us in the very opening page of the book itself how she got started. And I'll read these lines. And they have a very special meaning for us because this was a passage that was very precious to our daughter, who also was a writer. Not she didn't write books, but she had begun to write before she went away. Now here's this passage which our Naomi liked to refer to. While I was beseeching our Lord today, this is the very beginning of the book now. While I was beseeching our Lord today that he would speak through me, since I could find nothing to say and had no idea how to begin to carry out the obligation laid upon me by obedience, that is, I had orders to do it, a thought occurred to me which I will now set down in order to have some foundations on which to build. I began to think of the soul as if it were a castle made of a single diamond or a very clear crystal in which there are many rooms, just as in heaven there are many mansions. Now if we think carefully over this, sisters, the soul of the righteous man is nothing but a paradise in which, as God tells us, he takes his delight. For what do you think a room will be like which is the delight of a king so mighty, so wise, so pure, and so full of all that is good? I can find nothing with which to compare the great beauty of a soul and its great capacity. In fact, however acute our intellects may be, they will no more be able to attain to a comprehension of this than to an understanding of God. For as he himself says, he created us in his image and likeness. Now, if this is so, and it is, there is no point in our fatiguing ourselves by attempting to comprehend the beauty of this castle. For though it is his creature, and there is therefore much difference, between it and God as between creature and creator, the very fact that his majesty says it is made in his image means that we can hardly form any conception of the soul's great dignity and beauty. Then she goes on to say that we certainly, a person ought to be able to say who he is. You ask a person who he is, and we should be able to state what it means to be a man. Well, of course, we have these discussions right around this fireplace. What is man, you see? Well, as she says, we should look at that. Let us now imagine that this castle, as I have said, contains many mansions. Some above, others below, others in each side. And in the center and midst of them all is the chiefest mansion where the most secret things pass between God and the soul. You must think over this comparison very carefully. Perhaps God will be pleased to use it to show you something of the favors which he is pleased to grant to souls and of the differences between them. So far as I have understood this to be possible. For there are so many of them that nobody could possibly understand them all, much less anybody as stupid as I. The Lord grants you these favors, it will be a great consolation to know that such things are possible. So the soul of man, that's what she writes about. The soul of man is like a beautiful castle made up of one single diamond. And within it there are many mansions. In many different positions. They don't run one after the other, but they are in different positions, some higher, some lower, some on this side, some on that side. And she says that in every mansion there are many rooms, all of them different, because no two people are exactly alike. And she says, now I'll describe some of these mansions, but I'm not going to describe all of them, because there are millions of them, really, millions of rooms. And I may not describe exactly what your experience is, but we will describe it in general. Let's see, she has just a little bit more to say about that. Let us now turn to our castle and to its many with its many mansions. You must not imagine these mansions as arranged in a row, one behind another, but fix your attention on the center, the room or palace occupied by the king. Think of a palmito, that's a certain kind of a shrub in Spain, which has many outer rinds surrounding the savory part within, all of which must be taken away before the center can be eaten. Just so around this central room are many more, as there are also above it. In speaking of the souls, we must always think of it as spacious, ample, and lofty. And this can be done without the least exaggeration, for the soul's capacity is much greater than we can realize, and this sun, which is in the palace, reaches every part of it. That is, God touches every part of the soul. It's very important that no soul who practices prayer, whether little or much, should be subjected to undue constraint or limitation. Since God has given it such dignity, it must be allowed to roam through these mansions, through those above, those below, and those on either side. It must not be compelled to remain for a long time in one single room, not at least unless it is in the room of self-knowledge. How necessary this is, that is, and be sure you understand me here, even to those whom the Lord keeps in the same mansion in which he himself is. However high a state of the soul may have attained, a state the soul may have attained, self-knowledge is incumbent upon it, and this it will never be able to neglect, even should it so desire. There's an interesting little note here which I thought of. She says about the soul must not be compelled to remain in a single room, not at least unless it is in the room of self-knowledge, whatever that means. Maybe she says that you don't have to get out very far fast out of studying yourself, because you need to be in that room. That's what the text says here, but now you know what it says. The autograph, that is the original manuscript, after the word had room, says in quotation, "Oh, but if it is in the room of self-knowledge." Now, previous editors have altered this difficult Spanish phrase it gives the Spanish, "not even if it is." You see? She said, "Oh, but if it is self-knowledge." And they couldn't make sense of, so they say, "not even if it is." Teresa's meaning, however, seems to be quite clearly the opposite of this, though it is impossible to pass that explanation literally. So it shows that they are working with a manuscript. There's another passage, I thought this was this one, where she had written, even though I maybe will come to it, yes, I guess we will come to it, where she had written, "I have never seen this myself." And the editor, his superior of hers, had written in, "I myself have seen it." Now, I don't know if he was putting himself in her place, but fortunately they got back to the original text. Well, that's her picture of the mansions. Now, then she says that the progress of the soul through this world is like moving from one mansion or the other, moving toward the central mansions where God himself is in all his glory, where you have the perfect fellowship with him. Now, she is writing about believers. She's not writing about the people of the world. She's writing about those people who are baptized people and who have some knowledge of Christ. But among these people, there are all different kinds, she says. And she describes them, these seven different types. She starts in by talking about the mansions that are farthest out. In fact, just inside the courtyard. And in the courtyard, there are all kinds of animals and creatures and snakes and worms and all sorts of things. And those who are in the first mansion are still somewhat taken up with those worms that are on the outside. In other words, they have a very weak kind of faith, and their chief interest is still in the world and in the things that are going on, like money making and whatever goes to make up the world. I think I can read you a little example of what it's like there. I can. I think I put down 39 here, and I should put down 29. Can't see. Oh, that's 20. That's where she tells how she started, but here are some of her descriptions of, yes, here we are, excuse me. I'm borrowing this book, you know, from the library because I didn't bring my own copy, I mean from the bookstore, because I didn't bring my own copy along, and therefore I can't make any checks in the margin, so I have to write it down here. Yesterday I had my own book, so I could check it there. Now, with regard to this first mansion, I can give some very useful information out of my own experience, she says. I must tell you, for example, to think of them as comprising not just a few rooms, but a very large number. There are many ways in which souls enter them, always with good intentions. But as the devil's intentions are always very bad, he has many legions of evil spirits in each room to prevent souls from passing from one to another. He wants to keep them at the lowest level and keep them as poor Christians and as worldly Christians as possible. And as we poor souls fail to realize this, we are tricked by all kinds of deceptions. The devil is less successful with those who are nearer the king's dwelling place. But at this early stage, as the soul is still absorbed in worldly affairs, engulfed in worldly pleasure, and puffed up with worldly honors and ambitions, its vassals, which are the senses and the faculties given to it by God as part of its nature, have not the same power, and such a soul is easily vanquished, loses temper right away, be tempted to dishonesty and profanity and one thing and another. She doesn't put them down that way, but we can read between the lines. Although it may desire not to offend God, it may perform good works. Those who find themselves in this state need to take every opportunity of repairing with His Majesty and to make His Blessed Mother their intercessor. He had a reference to Mary, and also His saints, so that these may do battle for them, since their own servants have little strength in defending themselves. In reality, it's necessary in every state of life for our help to come from God. May His Majesty grant us this through His mercy. How miserable is this life which you live? As I've said a great deal elsewhere, daughters, about the harm which comes to us through our not properly understanding this matter of humility and self-knowledge. I'm not saying more to you here, though it is a matter of greatest importance to us. May the Lord grant that something I've said will be of use to you. You must note that the light which comes from the palace occupied by the king hardly reaches these first mansions at all. For although they are not dark and black, as when the soul is in the state of sin, when they haven't found Christ at all, they are to some extent darkened so that they cannot be seen, I mean by anyone who is in them. And this not because of anything that is wrong with the room, but rather, I hardly know how to explain myself, she says, because there are so many bad things, snakes and vipers and poisonous creatures, which have come in with the soul that they prevent it from seeing the light. It's as if one were to enter a place flooded with sunlight with his eyes so full of dust that he could hardly look upon. Well, that's the first mansion. And then she goes on from there. She calls this, I believe, the mansion of humility. Humility. You don't get anywhere unless you have a humble heart and want to learn something. And by the way, she started out by just having the seven chapters, but she divided them up. Now she says the first mansions in which there are two chapters, and then the second mansion in which there are so many chapters.
Yeah.
Now the second mansion has to do with earnest prayer, with careful prayer. That's the second. So when you get to the place where you are really praying to grow in the spiritual life and in the love of God, and you're in the second mansion. The third mansion is what she calls the exemplary life. By the way, in that second one, he says sermons and good company and good reading and all these things are important if you want to grow. If you just want to be inside the border and be called a Christian but don't care to get anywhere, well then don't do any reading, don't do much praying, don't go to church very much. But the second mansion, these things are important. And then the third she calls exemplary life. And you struggle more to be very careful not to offend the spirit in your heart or in your life, but to live the good life to the utmost with discipline and some penance. And she says that sometimes along about this time the soul gets arid, dry, tired, doesn't know whether it wants to go on or not. However, when you come into the fourth mansion, then you are coming into the, to the richer, the more perfected, or the more, yes, the more complete life of the spirit. She calls that the prayer of quiet. The prayer of quiet. In one of her other books, it's called The Place of the Second Water. Place of the Second Water. That's an interesting title. And by that is meant. And as I say, here are the points where I begin to feel very definitely my own inadequacy to try to explain. But she says it's like a, in the early stages of the Christian life, why it's more like you get water from the well, but it comes through an aqueduct, and it requires some effort to pump it up there. But when you come to the fourth mansion, then you are in more direct touch with the stream, and the life of God is flowing through you with less effort. And the spiritual life becomes more joyful to you. You aren't wishing you could be out among the vipers and the snakes out in the world anymore. This is the area where the supernatural, where God is permitted to take over more. Now the fifth, in fact, all of the remaining Catholic mansions then describe this, you might call, the fuller spiritual life, the life of greater freedom, of greater unity with God, of oneness with Him. The fifth mansion is called the mansion of spiritual betrothal, or the third water instead of the second, incipient spiritual union. I don't know if you're familiar with the terms that were used very much by the spiritual directors in the Middle Ages. They usually classified three levels of the spiritual life. The purgative, when you're mostly struggling against sin. The illuminative, when you are beginning to enjoy more of the spiritual life. And then the unitive, when the soul has perfect union with God. Those three levels. Well, this would correspond to the second level, maybe some transition between the second and the third level. And they use the expression, the author here uses the expression infused contemplation. I wonder how many of you have heard that expression. Heard the expression infused contemplation. Well, I'll try to put it into a few words. In my ignorance, the great tradition in the spiritual life puts very much stress on contemplation. And by contemplation is meant prayer, not necessarily with words, it could be with words, but more the sense of the feeling of the presence of God in the soul. Contemplation, thinking about God, wanting to be like Him, loving Him, so on, thinking of Him. I'm sure that perhaps every single person here, you've had that experience sometime or other. Maybe you've been out for a walk. Maybe you're sitting alone in church, not without a lot of people talking around you, as they sometimes do in church and disturb you, but maybe you're in your own room. And the presence of God is real to you, and you see how worthwhile this life in the spirit is. It's just convincing. And sometimes you wish. By the way, this is the kind of language used often here. I can't pick out all the passages, but many times she'll say that these moments come to you. And sometimes they're very short. She says very, very short. Sometimes she says it's so short that you might think that it couldn't do much good. But she says it does, and it doesn't do much good. And I think this is echoes, finds echo in our hearts. Now that's contemplation. That's a very imperfect description of contemplation. But it is a description. Now infused contemplation, as I understand, because if somehow God takes over, you see, and you don't have to put, you get beyond your own effort. And God is praying within you. The Spirit is praying within you. And you are conscious, and yet the spring is flowing. The stream is flowing. That's what the writers write about. And those of us who haven't had much experience, like myself, we can only... I know that these things are true because I've read it in so many, many books, you know. They sort of harmonize with each other. They don't all make the exact plan the same thing, but they all say essentially the same thing. Just like if you ask one geologist, just you ask another geologist, why, they tell you about the same things. And so it is with this spiritual life. Well, infused contemplation. Now, not many of you were here. Maybe none of you was here when I discussed this speaking in tongues, you know, this movement. And I hadn't thought of it before, but in connection with today, I've been thinking if there's a relation between this praying in tongues, which so many of our friends are doing now, you know. There have been people right here at camp, you know, since we've been here. I mean, at Holden, who one young man I talked to described very simply how much it meant to him, this thing called praying in tongues. And as you read the description, I think there is some similarity. And I think, and this is just in passing, that this may be one reason why this so-called tongue movement is gaining a great and widespread interest in the Catholic Church in America today. Well, that's just a guess on my part. Well, that's the fifth level. And as I say, I feel about this as I imagine some of you feel as you listen even to this, you can feel a little embarrassed. You say, well, can this be so? And I feel that same thing, but it's nice to have someone like St. Teresa to walk with, because she is a very common and ordinary person. She was a very practical person, very practical and successful administrator, and utterly humble, you see. So, and she, every time she gets through describing some wonderful spiritual experience, she says, now don't think that you can do all this by yourself, and don't think that this is going to be necessarily permanent, because the devil isn't going to let you go that easily, and so on. He talks about that. Well, that's the fifth spiritual betrothal, and then the sixth carries that a little further. She says that spiritual betrothal is something like really falling in love. You know, you've known the person all the time before, but now you fall in love. That's what this life is like. And the sixth level, or the sixth dimension, is when the lovers spend more time with each other and learn to know each other better and so on. And then the seventh mansion is spiritual marriage, where there is that she uses the expression that the God and the soul come together like two lighted candles become one, or like the drop of water falls into the falling rain falls into the river or into the ocean, and the two are blended. But I even referred to this in my talk the other evening, that even St. Teresa, with all her wonderful insights, she right up to the end, she said, well, remember, this has to be a day-by-day thing, and it's possible to get away from God. But I don't think that she wants to overdo that either, because she knows that if you go on in the spiritual life, it's so convincing that money or honor or whatever these earthly things could be They just simply, we know inherently that, that these things are not of the same value. Now, I'd like to do two things. I wonder if I have time for them. This matter of spiritual union, the union of the soul with God, in the fullest earthly sense of that, I don't think that, I really don't think that so very many people achieve it. But that is, I mean, among the millions. It doesn't mean that there aren't thousands. But, and even for those of us who may not feel that we can ever reach that, it's worth something to us, I think, to make contact with those who have. Now, one of those most outstanding in the history of, they usually say the history of mysticism, I don't like to use that word too much, I like better to say the history of prayer, because mysticism at its best really is intense prayer, is a friend of St. Teresa's called St. John of the Cross. You may know some of his poems. I just want to read, for one thing here, a couple of stanzas from his from one of his poems. He has many other poems that express this same idea of the blessedness of the soul's union with God. The blessedness of the soul's union with God. And incidentally, this book too, this writer too, was much beloved by our Naomi. Let me read just a few lines. And if you feel, well, this is way beyond me, then you're in the same class as I am. That's the way I feel too. But here's what he writes. He was a man who was persecuted for this, spent quite a time in prison. Not put in prison by the world, but by his fellow Jesuits. I don't know if he was could he be a Jesuit? No, he was a Carmelite, I think, the same as she was. And they were friends. She was kind of his spiritual son, her spiritual son. And much of his best writing was done while he was in prison. I entered in, I know not where, and I remained, though knowing not, transcending knowledge with my thought. Of when I entered, I know not, but when I saw that I was there, though where it was, I did not care. Strange things I learned with greatness fraught, yet what I heard I'll not declare. But there I stayed, though knowing not, transcending knowledge with my thought. Of peace and piety interwound, this perfect science had been wrought. Within the solitude profound, a straight and narrow path it taught. Such secret wisdom there I found, that there I stammered, saying naught, but topped all knowledge with my thought. So borne aloft, so drunk and reeling, so wrapped was I, so swept away, within the scope of sense or feeling, my sense or feeling could not stay, and in my soul I felt revealing a sense that though its sense was not, transcended knowledge with my thought. Now just one little part of St. John of the Cross. Now the other thing that I want to do is to direct our attention for a few minutes to what I think is the most beautiful of the parables of Saint Teresa, and her portrayal under this picture portrayal of the silkworm. You will have heard of the wonderful way. This is in the fifth mansion when you're getting closer to the building. You will have heard of the wonderful way in which the silk is made, a way which no one could invent but God, and how it comes from a kind of seed which looks like tiny peppercorns. Then in parentheses, this is the passage I mentioned, she writes, I have never seen this, but only heard it, so if it is incorrect, in any way the fault is not, if it's incorrect, in any way the fault is not mine. She says, I mean, I'm just telling it the way I heard it. And here Gracian crossed that out and put it instead, it is so, but I've seen it. Well, when the warm weather comes and the mulberry trees begin to show leaf, the seed starts to take life. Until it has this sustenance on which it feeds, it is as dead. The silkworms feed on these mulberry leaves until they are full grown, and people put down twigs upon which, with their tiny mouths, they start spinning silk, making themselves a very tight little cocoons in which they bury themselves. Then finally the worm, which was large and ugly, comes right out of the cocoon, a beautiful white butterfly. Now if no one had ever seen this, and we were only told about it in the story of past ages, who would believe it? And what arguments could we find to support the belief that a thing as devoid of reason as a worm or a bee could be diligent enough to work so industriously for our advantage, and that in such an enterprise the poor little worm would lose its life? This alone, sisters, even if I tell you no more, is sufficient for a brief meditation, for it will enable you to reflect upon the wonders and the wisdom of our God. What then would it be if we knew the properties of everything? It'll be a great help to us if we occupy ourselves in thinking of these wonderful things and rejoice in being the brides of so wise and powerful a king. But to return to what I was saying, the silkworm is like the soul which takes life when, through the heat which comes from the Holy Spirit, it begins to utilize the general help which God gives to all, and to make use of the remedies which he has left in his church, such as frequent confessions, good books, and sermons. For these are the remedies for a soul dead in negligences and sins and frequently plunged in temptation. The soul begins to live and nourishes itself on this food and on good meditations until it is full grown. And this is what concerns me now. The rest is of little importance. When it is full grown, then, as I wrote in the beginning, it starts to spin its silk and to build the house in which it is to die. That's the point. This house may be understood here to mean Christ. I think I read or heard somewhere that our life is hid in Christ or in God. Of course, she did because it's in Colossians. So that is the same thing. Or that our life in Christ, the exact form of this, is little to my purpose. Here then, my daughters, you see what we can do with God's favor. May his majesty himself be our mansion, as he is in this prayer of union, which, as it were, we ourselves spin. When I say that he will be our mansion, and we can construct it for ourselves and hide ourselves in it, I seem to be suggesting that we can subtract from God or add to him. But of course, we can't possibly do that. We can neither subtract from nor add to God, but we can subtract from and add to ourselves, just as those little sick silkworms do. And before we have finished doing all that we can in this respect, God will take this tiny achievement of ours, which is nothing at all, unite it with his greatness, and give it such a worth that its reward will be the Lord himself. And as it is he whom it has cost the most, so his majesty will unite our small trials with his great trials which he suffered, and make both of them into one. On then, my daughters, let us hasten to perform this task and spin this cocoon. Let us renounce our self-love and self-will and our attachment to earthly things. Let us practice penance, prayer, mortification, obedience, and all the other good works that you know of. Let us do what we have been taught and we have been instructed about what our duty is. Let the silkworm die. Let it die, as in fact it does when it has completed the work which it was created to do. Then we shall see God and shall ourselves be as completely hidden in his greatness as is this little worm in its cocoon. Note that when I speak of seeing God, I'm referring to the way to which, as I've said, he allows himself to be apprehended in this kind of meeting. Now let us see what becomes of this Silper, for all that I have been saying about it is leading up to this. When it is in this state of prayer and quite dead to the world, it comes out a little white butterfly. Oh, the greatness of God, that a soul should come out like this after being hidden in the greatness of God, closely united to him for such a short time, never, I think, for as long as half an hour. I tell you truly, the very soul does not know itself, for think of the difference between an ugly worm and a white butterfly. Just the same here, the soul cannot think how it can have merited such a blessing, whence such a blessing should have come to it, I mean to say, for it knows quite well that it has not merited it at all. It finds itself so anxious to praise the Lord that it would gladly be consumed and die a thousand deaths for his sake. Then it finds itself longing to suffer great trials and unable to do otherwise. It has the most vehement desires for penance, for solitude, and for all to know God. As hence, when it sees God being offended, it becomes greatly distressed. In the following mansion, we shall treat of these things further in detail, for although the experiences of this mansion and of the next are almost identical, their effects come to have much greater power. For as I've said, after all, if after God comes to a soul here on earth, it strives to progress still more, it will experience great things. Well, there's more to it. She enlarges upon further, but I think I'll stop there. It gives us that wonderful and famous parable of hers, that the soul must die in God in order to live again in God. This is one of the places. There are other places too, but here's one where she says that it isn't a matter of a long time, but it's a matter of a complete self-giving to God. Butterfly to be born. Well, the time's past due. Anybody have any comment? If this is your first, for many of you, it's the first contact with the interior castle. How do you react to it? You know, we can get tied up in things ourselves and quite enthusiastic about them, and it may not seem the same to other people at all. And of course, I feel I have to say this again. You must remember that she guards herself all along the way. Now, this looks like I'm marking on a path, and this is the path you have to go. Oh, no, that aren't any of others here, but this is the general direction. And perhaps we could start a real discussion here if we had time and if we wanted to. We don't have time, and I think we perhaps don't want to. But it would be easy after an hour like this to say, well, now, this was fine in the 15th century or 16th century in Spain, you know, where they had lots of monasteries and monks and nuns and one thing and another. But the 20th century, the same today. By the way, we have Bonhoeffer coming out tomorrow. See, he's the same for today. And that's, somebody might say, well, this is what concerns us today. What do you do for the Negroes? What do you do about the unjust, the injustice, and the poor? So, here's St. Teresa sitting in a castle over there, or walking around and giving instructions to the nuns. The nuns are coming out of the monasteries today and putting on other dresses and so on. So there would be, we could have quite a discussion on that point. I personally don't think the two are, incompatible.
Wasn't this in Hollisby's prayer about Miss Yetta Hinderly, who through prayer
yes.
sent this prisoner to the mission field?
Well, no, you are just sort of scratching my memory, and I don't have it clear, but I think...
Well, mine too, in a way.
Is that in his book on prayer?
Yes, Hollisby's Prayer.
Did you ever? I don't remember that it was in that book.
Yes, and she's a relative, I think she's an aunt of Carol Hinderly, because I brought it up to him when I heard his name first, that rang a bell with me, and I just read it.
And he said that it was his aunt?
Yes, that's what she's saying. But at any rate, what I mean though is that her terrific belief in prayer and the power of prayer, she's accomplishing.
Yes.
A lot in the world.
Yes. This would be another discussion, wouldn't it? You know, here she's talking about prayer as a pathway to union with God. But you are suggesting prayer as a means of doing work.
Yes, without involving herself even. She was a country lady and...
Yeah. That's right.
But she had concern for her souls and her fellow men.
I'm sure that we need to be taught along these lines, you know. And nobody who has tried it, or even if you haven't tried it, you can know that that this is not an easy thing to do, to carry on the work of prayer, you know. There have been some great prayers in the world, like Praying High, we used to read about years ago. And you know, Dr. Hollisby has another of his books. I remember which one. He tells about Pastor Zeller down in Switzerland, who he visited and he made a permanent impression on him by his spiritual personality.
Dr. Christensen, I find it something like this. To me, they're very remote.
You find them remote?
Yes, we live in a time when things are done on a time schedule. Things are very well, pretty well organized for us.
Yeah.
And we just, either we don't take the time or we don't have the time to do this type of thing. And I don't see a very close relationship between this book and our century.
Yeah.
And I find it very hard. These people speak of praying for long hours.
Well, she does.
She said only half an hour was long enough. But she must have awfully good concentration, because I don't get too much out of mine.
What is that?
I say, yeah, sometimes when she prays, she seems to have this union of spirit with God.
Yes.
Well, I haven't gotten there yet.
No. Well, I think that's what I said at the beginning, you know, that...
Of course, it took her 20 years to do it, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
20 years, yes, before that was a striking thing, before this became real to her, you know. Yes, take Hollisby's case himself, you know, he was a complete unbeliever, you know. He went to the university and followed by the way of unbelief. There was some people at his home, some common people that were not believing. So this is something to be... always to be remembered, I think. Now, of course, this is strictly in the Catholic tradition. Hollisby's book on prayer would not read like this in many respects. But I find myself that the essence of the thing is the same. It doesn't make any difference whether you're in the monastery or outside the monastery. The essence of the thing is the same. It's just as easy to lose your temper in the monastery as in the office or in the school. And to be offended or so on. It's the human being, you know. You carry yourself with you wherever you go. Well, I think that more than finishes us, of course, dating. But these books, you know, only 95 cents paperback. And easily available. This happens to be image books. There are many of those image books. And of course, now there are so many sets of paperbacks. Isn't it amazing that it took us all that time to come here? All this has come out in the last 20 years. Why didn't we start that before? Just think of the money we saved and the more room we didn't even get back. By the way, Mr. Johnson, I think it was, gave me this copy of Frank and Zoe we were talking about yesterday. Zoe. And I did read the lecture.